You're listening to 88.5 KNKX. I'm Ed Ronco. We've added some new programming here on KNKX, including the show On Being, which explores some of the larger questions at the center of human life. It is a warm and wonderful show with guests from all walks of life, faith and spirituality, the arts, politics, and so much more. I spoke to the host, Krista Tippett, about how she does the show, and here's something you should know about On Being. Every single conversation they do airs in an hour-long program on the radio, but is also posted online in its unedited form. So, true to the spirit of the show, we've chosen to do the same thing with our interview. What you're about to hear is our unedited conversation. Well, let me just jump right in then, and I'm going to kind of begin where you begin. You start each interview by asking your guests, no matter who it is, you know, clergy or actors or Glenn Beck, poets, you begin by asking them about their faith or spiritual background from earlier in their lives. Why is it important to start that way?
You know, it's so just about everybody, whoever they are, however religious or non-religious they are, just about everybody has a great story. But the reason I do it is because of where it plants the conversation. It actually is kind of a magic question. It would be very off-putting for any of us, including me, to say, tell me about your spiritual life now. Right? Like, there's no question that would make most of us freeze more. But there's something about inquiring, and I would say the spiritual or religious background of your childhood. There's something about inquiring about that. That is a place in all of our memory that is soft and searching and has a lot of questions attached. And I find that starting the conversation there affects everything from there on out. Just on Monday night, I interviewed Ta-Nehisi Coates in Chicago with 1,500 people and asked him that question. And he's not a religious person at all. I mean, he actually has written a lot about being, as he says, a black atheist. But he actually said at one point, wow, this is bringing up all these interesting things. For him, it was about how they revered ancestors and family. And I often find that where people go with that question ends up to be something that they've been true to in their lives, whatever they did.
It informs more than just the religious specific part of the answer.
Yeah, that there are things fermenting in whatever that is. You know, and it's really expansive for me now, the religious or spiritual background. Things fermenting there that are really defining that we end up following in the rest of our lives.
And do you find that it leads then to people saying, you know, and now I feel, you know?
What often happens is that when I have a conversation with someone, that at some point they come back to whatever that answer was. Like at some point, it's like, oh, and then when I became a neurosurgeon, wow, I was working with that same question, right? Or something like that. Well, I just interviewed Atul Gawande, right? He writes about being mortal. And, you know, he talked about the Hindu background of his family steeped in that, immigrants from India, and how he never put his foot on a book because books were sacred. And that to this day, he doesn't put his foot on a book. But also, there were things about how Hinduism is so much less a set of beliefs than it is kind of like he said the way you treat your parents is like inseparable from whatever it is to be Hindu. And, you know, the conversation ended up coming back to how he's reflected on the aging and death of his parents and grandparents as he like is on this frontier of, you know, our encounter with death and what technology makes possible and the decisions we have to make.
Wow. You know, On Being is an hour-long show, but obviously in radio, you know, we don't just talk to somebody for an hour and then put it all on the air. So I'm wondering, how long is your average conversation when you're in the studio just doing the raw conversation?
Yeah, I generally do a 90-minute conversation. And when I first started doing this, which was 15 years ago, people just told me that's not done, even for the raw. But it's just how long it takes. And then we have to edit it down, you know, to about 52 minutes. The show is like something like 52 minutes. So it's about 45 minutes of conversation that makes it through.
Yeah. And when you're deciding, you know, to go from 90 to essentially half of that, what are you listening for? What makes a good conversation?
The thing about having a 90-minute conversation is that you can let people wander, right? Like, very intentionally. It can be nonlinear. It can be like a real conversation, which does not stay on point. And because I have 90 minutes with people, you know, it happens a lot that somebody starts walking down a road in an answer, and I think when they start going there that it's probably not going to go anywhere. And it may be kind of rambly, and it may be inaccessible. But so, you know, so I can let them do that. And every once in a while, there's just an incredible, you know, get like that, like it, where that ends. It goes on for 10 minutes, and it ends in this incredible place that we wouldn't have gotten to otherwise. And sometimes it's just a detour, and I pull the conversation back. So it's partly things like that. You know, creating that space so that that can happen. But, you know, it's a different discipline from what you do and what I do when I'm doing a live event. You know, then I'm much more, I don't want to say controlling, but, you know, driving the conversation. And that also has its value. Like, I actually like both. But, yeah, when we release the unedited interview also, and we find that people are really interested, and that surprises me because the unedited, I mean, there are the occasional people who can be word perfect for 90 minutes, but most of us really could live with digital editing and improve with digital editing, including in our private lives. And, you know, we can take somebody who's already wise and really kind of edit to the core of what they said. And that's just so powerful.
I want to preface this question a little bit with something from my own experience I find that when I'm doing an interview, especially if I'm on the air at the time and not taping, it's hard for me to listen without thinking about, you know, where the levels are moving and how much time we have left and whether all of my questions are being answered and what's the next question. And so when you're in the middle of an interview and you have all these things you want to ask somebody and all this ground you want to cover, how are you able to clear space in your head to listen? How do you listen?
So I do a big amount of preparing. So I have a lot of notes in front of me. I also have a kind of roadmap. I know where we're going to start, and I'm pretty sure I know where we're going to end, and I have a sense of where we'll go in the middle. But I think the point of being that prepared is to be able to wander and still really be able to stay with someone. I do a lot of preparing, but I have to say that I think that actually helps me when I actually get into the interview, just completely be present and be listening. I mean, it's not that I'm not looking at my notes, but, here's the way I think about it. I think the point of preparing is not to know what they know, but to try to get a sense of how they think so that when I'm with them, I can be following and thinking alongside them. And that kind of that approach to being prepared means that I really can be listening and have a confidence in that. I don't know. I'm talking to you like I know that you are getting so inside this and I know what you're saying. It's also something I've done now for a while. Like I've gotten to be a much better listener. It's like anything else, like any other muscle that you flex. So yeah. I really am. But I do think listening is about presence. It's about really walking into that space and saying, you know, this is about them and being present to that. It's also being present with my reactions, you know.
And maybe asking a question based off of that surprised me or that it startles me that you would say that or what have you. Does that carry over into your personal life? I mean, when you spend every day listening so intently to people and preparing for these conversations, and then you're talking to your kids or you're talking to somebody at the grocery store or whatever. I mean, are you a better listener now all these years after having done this show?
I probably am, but you know, I used to, people used to say to me, oh, you're so soothing. And you're so, and I was like, talk to my teenage children. This is not, you know, so I don't, most life experiences, including being with your children, do not afford the kind of beautiful preparation that I do for my interviews. So I'm winging it more and that's messy.
Yeah. You've been hosting this. The show has been nationally distributed for since 2003. And how long have you been doing the show overall? Because it started in Minneapolis.
It did, but really, I started doing pilots. I pitched it in 2000 at NPR and started doing pilots, but just for a couple of years it was never weekly. It basically went weekly and national at the same time, which is kind of strange, and it's not the way most of the shows we know went. I mean, most of the shows that you think of as these staples on public radio, even like This American Life or Fresh Air or Car Talk, they all had long incubation periods as local shows. Hmm. And boy, there's an advantage to that, because our show just had to grow up in public, and you don't come out fully formed. You know, it takes years to find your voice and for the project to find its voice. And I think, you know, when I first pitched the idea in public radio for a show about, you know, these big questions and kind of the spiritual and religious part of life, which is, you know, very expansively understood, there was a big wariness about that. And I think in some places there's still a wariness about it. But then after 9/11, in those early years of the 2000s, you know, we had 9/11, we had an evangelical president in the White House. There was a lot of religion in headlines. Mm-hmm. But very superficial, and you know, part of what I was saying is we must be able to approach this with the kind of intelligence and sophistication that we give to other subjects. And then I think because all of that was so much in the news, it always felt like a national conversation, right? And because there wasn't much about it. But there's an upside and a downside to that, because we definitely, I think this has been an evolutionary project. And what you hear today is very different than what you would have heard in 2003.
Well, and our religious or spiritual beliefs often come with such a short label, you know, Catholicism or atheism or what have you. And yet when you get people on Being, and they start explaining, there's so much nuance and so much texture there, and you really have an opportunity to explore that.
Yeah, exactly. It needs more. This part of life does not lend itself to sound bites. Just doesn't.
Yeah. So that leads me to ask you, you know, how do you describe the show when you're talking to people who have never heard it? Because it feels, you know, on one hand, your show feels very specific in that it deals with religion or spirituality or kind of those larger life questions. On the other hand, it's very broad, right? Because you have this variety of guests from different backgrounds. So how do you shorthand that, speaking of not lending itself to sound bites? But
yeah, well, no, I think that the answer I give now would be different from what I would have given a few years ago. But how the show has evolved is to be about the big questions of meaning at the center of human life, and the truth is, and how 21st century people are picking those questions up anew. You know, what does it mean to be human? How do we want to live? How we are wrestling with those in new ways. And and we can talk to anybody, right? I mean, I talk to a lot of people who are not religious, but who may be in neuroscience, or who may be in physics, or who may be on, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's on the front lines of our national conversation about race, and is, you know, not a religious person. But these are questions of what it means to be human. And so this, you know, this big grappling, and I, you know, I think these are some of the things we long to talk about and to let our minds, you know, give our minds some time to chew over them and wrap around them. But they do need some time and space and some depth. And so it's, you know, and it's such a luxury that we can have on public radio to have an hour, to have a big conversation that goes somewhere.
How did you, well, how, I want to ask you how you came to, you know, focusing on this subject area, and it feels like such a broad question, but you started as a, you know, I was reading your bio, and you started as working kind of for traditional news outlets, and then shifted into, you know, really focusing on theology and faith and spirituality and what your show is about now. And how do you make that shift? Like, what steered you there?
I actually grew up in Oklahoma, I grew up Southern Baptist. And then, like a lot of people, I went to college. I went to college on the East Coast. I completely lost interest in religion. I didn't even think about it or talk about it for a good 10 years. I ended up as the New York Times stringer in Divided Berlin. I was with the State Department there, so I was totally focused on politics and, you know, geopolitics and nuclear weapons. But in Berlin, I also started to see, you know, across that wall that divided the city during the Cold War, there was also this human dimension of what happened when you, you know, in these two very different worlds and worldviews. And I started to feel like that was as important and as meaningful for the future as that this big geopolitical level of the missiles we were pointing at each other. And I honestly, and I didn't think about that as spiritual for a long time. And I only reluctantly started to say, well, you know, theology is this discipline where we've actually asked these questions of how people create dignity and beauty and intimacy in their lives, like how we make meaning in life. So I actually went and studied theology to keep asking those questions and also just to test. I mean, I was having this feeling that religion was an important force in the world and that I wanted to take seriously. But I honestly was surprised at this impulse in myself. And so I went to Yale Divinity School and studied for 3 years. And then that brought me back out into the world as a journalist. I mean, you know, somebody who was trained as a journalist with the eyes of a journalist. And I was just appalled at how there was just this big black hole where all the things we talk about when we talk about religion, spirituality, ethics, that we just didn't make space for them, you know, and that we make space for talking about politics, economics, the arts, and not inner life. So it was kind of these two things coming together, like what I'd done before and then asking this whole new set of questions coming out of studying theology. And then I really felt like public radio is, you know, was the place where you should be able to pick up this subject and give it the kind of intelligence that we give to other subjects.
When I hear your show, and I hope I'm not taking any liberties here, but I hear someone who really feels fulfilled by what she's doing. I when I hear you hosting, it sounds, I just imagine you showing up really kind of stimulated by your work every day. Is that true? I mean, are you having fun?
I am having fun, but you know, there's so many other things that I have to do at work aside from walking in and having the conversation. So yes, and I think part of what you know, this is an amazing, tumultuous, this moment we inhabit is just, it's big. And I think it is bringing us, you know, it's bringing us again to these questions of what it means to be human and also who we are to each other, right? To me, as I watched 2016, like I thought whoever was going to win, whoever had won, that is this big question in our midst. And that's kind of the direction the show has gone also. And, you know, what is common life going to be for this century? And I think that is an existential question, and it's more practically existential now than it ever has been in human history. So, yeah, I'm very energized by the work that is to be done and this little piece of the work that I have. And it's also, you know, it's a stressful moment to be alive, and I feel that just as much as anybody else.
Your show is a constant pursuit of these bigger questions. And unlike, say, a news program where, you know, there are concrete answers to some things, you know, this is what happened today. This is what the president said. This is what Congress did. Your show doesn't necessarily always arrive at concrete answers. Is that ever unsatisfying to not ever arrive at, okay, now I understand it?
No, because I think that our whole drive to always have answers and resolution is not merely, but think about it. You know, the resolution that we have in any given newscast and then the speculating we do about what will happen next, it's just an illusion. I mean, I believe that obviously there's a place for answers and solution and certainly action. I think we have impoverished ourselves in this culture by not letting our questions have their place. Because right now, in the middle of our life together, there are a lot of vast questions and uncertainties and confusion and things that are just too complicated to have answers right away. And we are not going to have answers to those kinds of things that we can all just be really happy with anytime soon. And I think acknowledging that and like creating some space where we hold our questions together, you know, where we start to define some questions we have in common. Questions make the world go around as much as answers. They always have better questions. In science, we know this, right? Like the only, you know, scientists are always so excited once they've discovered something immediately to start asking, what are the new questions I don't know the answers to? And you know, we actually don't reward in political life, which is so dysfunctional now, we don't even reward people changing their minds, right? It's ridiculous. Like growth and becoming more whole and more wise is always about, you know, living with your convictions, but also honoring your questions and knowing what you don't know. And I think to live in this century and really grapple with some of the things we have to grapple with, that is a new muscle we have to flex. So I love talking to people who hold their questions alongside their answers and their curiosity alongside their convictions.
Well, we are so excited to be starting to grapple with some of those questions on KNKX tonight when your show airs for the first time on our station. And I'm curious, what is on tonight's show?
Tonight is Jonathan Haidt, who wrote a book called The Righteous Mind. And he's one of the most interesting people on some of these frontiers we're on now of understanding our brains, understanding why we drive each other crazy, understanding why we contradict ourselves, and also some really practical tools about how to get out of some of these ruts we're in how we categorize the other. And I think it's big thinking, and it's also something you can work with.
All right. Well, we're going to hear that tonight at 7 o'clock. And I want to ask you one more question. You are an interviewer, of course. You're a master interviewer, I would say. Is there a question you wish I had asked, or do you wish you get asked more often in interviews?
No, I think you did. Oh, I think I loved.
I wasn't fishing.
No. The fact that this conversation is already over and it felt like it lasted about 5 minutes is a great sign. A conversation is an adventure. I loved it. And I'm so, so happy to be on in Seattle.